From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Coach O'Nally. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Brianne Nadeau. She's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 1. But first, joining us is Christian Dorsey, a member of the Arlington County Board. Christian Dorsey, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, Kojo. Thank you.
Tom Sherwood, before we get to Virginia, let's start out in Maryland because, you know, Michael Steele has decided to have an exploratory committee for a possible gubernatorial bid. And if, of course, he does that, we'll be happy to welcome him back as one of the former victims, I mean guests of the show that we've had in the past. But it looks like this former lieutenant governor of Maryland, former chair of the Republican National Committee, is eyeing a run for governor.
This is not a surprise. It's been a lot of speculation, and he hasn't discouraged it. And it's pretty clear he's not sugarcoating this exploratory committee. It's called Michael Steele for Governor Exploratory Committee. You know, some people put a fancy name on it, Good Government Maryland or something like that. He's going straight at this. He's going to travel around the state. He's going to decide whether, in fact, to get into the race right now. Commerce Secretary Kelly Schultz is the major candidate endorsed by much of the GOP establishment, or at least backing. Also, Delegate Daniel Cox of Frederick, who is a Trump acolyte, has gotten into the race, and of course, frequent candidate Robin Ficker's in. But Michael Steele, you know, who was the first African-American to serve statewide, would provide a great deal of interest in the Republican Party, even though Maryland is a blue Democratic state. Governor Hogan has been a two-term Republican governor with very strong popular appeal. I would think Steele would try to recreate that.
And speaking of familiar voices on this broadcast, it looks like there'll be one such who is going to be the next head of the U.S. Capitol Police, former Fairfax and former Montgomery County Police Chief Thomas Manger has been the one who has been apparently pinpointed for this job. He said when he watched the Capitol 6th rebellion at the Capitol, the invasion, so to speak, of the Capitol, he felt like putting his uniform back again, and it looks like he will soon be.
You know, we don't discuss these questions before the show, and I wrote down the same thing. He told the Washington Post that when he saw that horrible insurrection on Capitol Hill, that I wish I hadn't retired. He's only 66. He has a distinguished career in Fairfax, where he started going from patrolman to chief and then serving, I think, 15 years in Montgomery County before stepping down, thinking he was going to retire. He has broad experience dealing with locals, state, regional, and federal officials. A lot of people are saying he's the perfect choice for the job. He understands bureaucracies. He understands the racial equities of the Capitol Hill Police Department. He understands that 2,300-member force needs to be brought into the modern era. He will help make firm decisions on how the Capitol grounds will be protected and not turned into a fortress like the White House.
And if he turns it into a fortress again, you'll have to cross swords with one Tom Sherwood. Our guest is
Absolutely.
Christian Dorsey, who is a member of the Arlington County Board. Christian Dorsey, let's start with regional news. The Transportation Planning Board, on which you sit, voted to continue with the Maryland Transit Project to widen Interstate 270 and replace the American Legion Bridge. Earlier this month, the board voted against continuing the project. You were one of the votes that flipped from no to yes for continuing the project. What changed for you?
Well, Kojo, what changed was that this project, which had been designed and offered clear benefits to ease congestion, which would have certainly induced more single occupancy vehicle traffic, but what it needed was a way to move more people along those investments via transit. And so, you know, while the infrastructure, you know, the road widening and the lanes could, in theory, support transit, what was missing was a commitment to provide the funding to make sure locally generated transit solutions could be developed, could be constructed, and then could be operated in the long term. And so that was really withheld from the project for many months during the TPB's consideration of it. And only in the last month were there some real firm commitments and timelines and efforts outlined that would engage in making sure that transit would really be a part of this project, and transit that came from local participation in what was needed. And with that progress, everything is not all done, but there was significant progress, and at least enough progress for me to move it along in the regional planning process.
Because transit is clearly one of their priorities, but can you remind us why Virginians are invested in this whole project?
Well, for Virginia, we've already made plans to bring dynamic tolling to the American Legion Bridge. And without improvements to the bridge, those investments in tolling that are producing new transit connections would face the same bottleneck that everyone else has. It would limit the utility of it. So we certainly want to see that we get a sustainable bridge improvement, and that there can be some degree of availability of reduced traffic flow as you cross the bridge into Maryland. So that makes sense for us. But certainly we don't want to have all of our transit investments just met with more single occupancy cars on the other side.
Tom Sherwood.
I have a question about your vote on the Transportation Planning Board. But first, I want to ask you politics. President Biden is going to be in near Boston tonight at 5 o'clock for a big rally. Are you going to be there?
I would, Tom. But guess what? I'm in Cambridge, Maryland right now doing some work with the Council of Governments. We're having our regional planning retreat. So I'm not going to be able to attend.
So you're not avoiding it. Okay, I got that. Let me go back to the. Let me go back. Thank you for being on the show. I went back and I watched the June meeting on the Transportation Board, and I watched the vote this week. Back in June, you said that the state, I'm going to summarize, that Maryland DDOT and the governor's people had not fully engaged the local community, particularly Montgomery County, making changes. And you said that this project, when you voted against it, is not quite ready for prime time. Mm-hmm. In the interim, you just mentioned that there were some suggested changes. Virtually every change that you mentioned that changed your vote are all prospective things down the road, not money. Maybe, yes, we'll build the American Legion Bridge so it can hold transit someday into the future. Yes, maybe we'll put some more money in another parkway in the Montgomery County. The bottom line is Mark Ellerich, the head of Montgomery County, says this project shortchanges the residents of the county, is designed in the 1950s, 1960s way, where it's going to be mainly more cars on more lanes, and we've proven that that doesn't work. So what was it precisely that really changed your mind? Were you lobbied by Governor Hogan? I happen to know he called Mayor Bowser and got two of Mayor Bowser's votes to switch from abstaining to voting for the project. I don't know what the details are, but were you contacted by anyone in Maryland to change your vote?
No, I wasn't contacted by any Maryland official. Certainly, I was contacted by lots of people over the month through some targeted campaigns to seek to put pressure on changing the vote. Had lots of conversations with Virginia planners, but really, I'll tell you precisely what allowed me to think that progress was being made in the right direction. What was hitherto all conceptual, Tom, you know, there's going to be $300 million over 50 years for transit. What we got was a clear establishment of what would be the minimums. We know that with the first flow of funds from the concessionaire payment, those funds are going to be put into transit development that's going to have not only significant local, meaning Maryland, participation in designing and development, but it has procedural guardrails before the project can proceed to make sure that there's some at least regional agreement on how those transit funds are spent. And then it outlines specifically a couple of Maryland-generated projects that are of importance to mitigate the impact of this that will absolutely be funded as a priority with these resources. So to me, that was enough progress.
I got it. Okay, let me just say that the Montgomery County leadership was still strongly opposed to it, even though they liked some of the changes. The next big deal, and you're not part of this, but people should know, the Board of Public Works, which is the crucial board in Maryland, meets on August the 11th, and that is another hurdle for Governor Hogan's plan. Because it's possible Peter Franchot, the chief financial officer of the state, comptroller, and Nancy Kopp, the treasurer, may vote to delay this project still to get more environmental concerns about it in transit. But it was a big vote, and it means a great deal for the region of Washington, whether this goes forward or not.
We're getting several callers already who'd like to address this next issue, so I'd better get to it. The Arlington County Board unanimously voted to create a community oversight board of the police department. This was one of the recommendations from the Police Practices Work Group. What will this community oversight board be able to do? It will apparently have subpoena power, but it won't be able to initiate investigations or discipline officers. So what powers will this board have to address issues?
Well, thanks, Gojo. It will have actually quite a lot of responsibility as well as authority. So one, we've never had the ability to have effective civilian oversight outside of the county board in Arlington. This codifies it. It's going to allow for there to be what we think is a very exciting approach to this, a concurrent investigatory model where we have an independent police auditor, an investigator who is able to, at the time the police department initiates an investigation, to help them develop the plan, to be a part of the interviews, and then to issue their own independent report on the investigation's findings. We think that's significant and helpful authority. And then beyond that, if for some reason that concurrent model that we think is artfully designed doesn't work and there are records that are being withheld, then the Civilian Oversight Board has an opportunity to get those via subpoena, significant authority. And we hope that certainly subpoena authority, while an effective tool, we hope it's rarely used, because that means that our whole concurrent model is not working. So I think this is an important step forward. And quite frankly, it provides a great level of oversight within what we were permitted to do under Virginia law.
Before I go to the phones, here's the part that confuses me, that the group will have the ability to subpoena police to investigate and scrutinize police actions on the one hand, but on the other hand, cannot initiate investigations. If the group cannot initiate investigations, how does it use its subpoena power to subpoena police to investigate police actions?
So, Kojo, it can initiate investigations. It just doesn't have its separate and sole investigatory capacity. And the reason for that, the reason we had to come to this elegant concurrent model for investigations, because even though the state law allows for broad powers, without getting too much into the details, it didn't allow the Civilian Oversight Board to actually have its own staff outside of counsel. So all of the staff are going to need to be hired under our form of government by our county manager. And that doesn't create the level of independence that's necessary to have investigatory authority that meets my criteria of being effectively independent. So with that as a constraint, we had to come up with a solution that allowed for there to be an independent person who was accountable to the Civilian Oversight Board, who could be a part of making sure that investigations take place effectively and transparently. So okay, that's why we had to do it that way.
Before I go back to Tom, here is Julius Spain, who identifies as president of the Arlington NAACP. Julius Spain, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Great. Thank you, Kojo, and hello, Christian. There's been a lot of work on this matter. You know, what is not an elegant concurrent model, I would say that much. But to Mr. Dorsey, I know we spoke recently, just want to hear from you. Do you feel this ordinance in itself, in and of itself, is actually equitable for the communities of color here in Arlington? And if so, why and how?
Sure. So thank you, Mr. Spain, who I know well. For the present, if there is a complaint that someone has about police conduct, they have to take that complaint to the police department, which can have a chilling effect, particularly if you feel like you have been a victim to discrimination, subject to disproportionate or inequitable policing. Having the only venue for you to take that complaint to the actual people who committed the offense against you is flat out wrong and inequitable. This provides a new venue where you can take it to a group of your peers, people that you should have faith once we stand it up, will hear that fairly and will investigate it thoroughly. So that is an extremely important step forward. And you can do so by providing as much detail as you are comfortable sharing. Again, you don't have to take it to the people who you believe have wronged you. You don't have to be subject to providing information that you're uncomfortable providing. And you can be assured that if the group of your peers in the community deem it worthwhile, they will investigate it thoroughly and offer conclusions on it. So I think that's an extremely important step to this.
Tom Sherwood.
Very quickly, how many members would there be of the Law Enforcement Civilian Review Board, and would there be a police officer or a law enforcement person on the board?
Thank you. There will be 7 members once we constitute it. No member of law enforcement can be okay on it. No one who has been a part of Arlington law enforcement can be on it.
Okay. Who will make these appointments?
The Arlington County Board.
Okay. You said in passing this that we have to set in place an opportunity here for the community to figure out if our police department is to be trusted. Do you trust the police department?
You know, I think our officers do a very good job. But, you know, trust is a difficult word because I don't trust that they have been right in every instance, that they have always been on the right side of what effective and just policing is. Of course not. But I think we have an agency that has proven to our community that they perform and do good work overall. And I realize you say something like that, people are like, but what about this one time? I don't deny those one times. But overall, absolutely, I think we've had a professional and effective and trustworthy police department.
Yeah, and excuse me, they contended that over the last 3 years, 639 hours of suspension have been doled out by the police department itself, and 11 officers were forced to leave the department. So the police department says it's trying. You think the civilian board will help them?
Absolutely, because
okay,
it will absolutely help.
Okay, here now is Jill in Arlington, Virginia. Jill, your turn.
Yes, I actually have 2 questions. The first one, personal for Christian Dorsey, is, why did you not only vote against but speak out against ensuring that 3 seats on the oversight board would go to people of color or people from marginalized communities? And my second question is about the way this is being presented to the public, because the county website today says that the community oversight board has independent investigative and subpoena power. And Takis actually repeats this in the board wrap-up video. He says they had independent investigatory authority. And this is actually something that I believe the county board rejected, the idea of independent investigatory power. And Takis also refers twice to the board's findings. And the county board actually in the meeting removed the provision for the oversight board to have findings. So I was wondering if you could speak to why this is being presented to the public in this way and that is not true to what we
allow
have.
Me, because we're limited on time, Christian Dorsey, to ask if you could make your response to the second part of the question briefly, because I kind of asked about that before, but if you could talk about greater linked about marginalized communities being on this board.
Sure, thank you. So, Jill, and I'll try to get to these. The As I explained at the board meeting at length, and I'd encourage you to listen to those remarks, this is not about saying that there shouldn't be three people of color on the board. It was to say that we shouldn't send a signal that three is somehow an acceptable minimum, meaning that there has to be other people who are on the board of a certain number. I think that as many qualified, interested people, most of whom should be people of color, from my perspective. And I don't want to send any implicit signal that three is somehow an acceptable number. I don't think that's what you do in an ordinance establishing a body. I would love to see this body made up of as many people of color who represent the diversity of Arlington County as a part of this board. As to your other piece, just to address them very, very quickly, the board does have independent investigatory authority. What it doesn't have is sole investigatory authority for the reasons that I talked about earlier. And we also had a healthy conversation about the semantics of the word findings at our board meeting. It is substantively indistinguishable from the word recommendations that we used, but we wanted to avoid ambiguity because the word findings has very different concepts in the Virginia enabling legislation, and we didn't want to confuse anyone.
Our guest is Christian Dorsey, a member of the Arlington County Board. Christian Dorsey, last weekend, the Arlington County Board unanimously approved to allow collective bargaining for county employees. This is in Virginia, a white-to-work state. You call this a win-win. Tell us why.
You know, so for our employees who have been seeking to have a voice in the direction of their work so that they can have a say in their living standards, the rules under which they work, contribute to ideas for greater productivity. This enables them to have that voice for management. It provides a very streamlined approach for how you can deal with the issues among various different bargaining units, sets up a structured way to have that dialogue. I believe fundamentally that structured dialogue is important. And when you can bring it to the workplace, you have the opportunity to get good results. This really just codifies and structures what has been our practice for a long time to engage employees. And I think we can do so in a way that empowers the employees and makes management better.
Tom Sherwood.
The Virginia still is a right-to-work state where you can't force a person to join a union or contribute to a union. But, you know, back in the 70s, the Supreme Court of Virginia said you couldn't even have unions. And
right.
This is an example of what's, when you change the leadership in Richmond, where the Democrats took control of the House and Senate, they have changed many ways that the local governments of Virginia can open up and take actions like allow unions. And you've got 4,000 employees. When do you think, will there be several unions or just or one? What do you expect among your 4,000 employees?
You know, I don't know how it's going to shake out. We have allowed for there to be five different bargaining units. And, you know, whether it is Ask Me, SEIU, Combination, or others that become the those representatives. I don't know what the answer to that is going to be, but we'll see.
It's a big change for Virginia.
It is. And Tom, I know you know this history, but the Supreme Court case which disallowed collective bargaining was a suit against Arlington, Virginia.
Right.
And
okay.
I feel pretty privileged that we're able to bring this back.
Only have about a minute left, so we'll get rid of the pleasantness by having you hear from Arthur in Rockville, Maryland. Arthur, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Gojo. I wanted to ask whether whether you recognize that what's going to happen with this very incoherent design here on the interchange when they pulled the eastern part of the the Beltway project, pulled the eastern part of the
only got 30 seconds.
You're going to create a tremendous choke point that's going to screw up the Beltway.
How do you feel about that, Christian Dorsey?
So I will say, Arthur, those details are going to need to be worked out within Maryland. I'm a regional representative who just wants to make sure that fundamentally the project provides the ability to move people more efficiently and provides the ability to do that via transit.
But he can't end Montgomery County residents' opposition to it. Christian Dorsey is a member of the Arlington County Board. Christian Dorsey, thank you very much for joining us. Up next is Brianne Nadeau, a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 1. I'm Kojo Nam. Welcome back. Tom Sherwood is still with us. He's our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Joining us now is Brianne Nadeau, a member of the D.C. Council, representing Ward 1. Brianne Nadeau, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Brianne Nadeau, D.C. is on track to hit the same number of homicides as all of last year, and it's only July. Last Friday, six-year-old Nyaya Courtney was shot and killed in Congress Heights. On Saturday, three people were shot outside of Nationals Park, causing panic within the stadium. And just last night, a shooting on 14th Street near Logan Circle, just essentially up the street from your ward, down the street from your ward, left two people injured. What do you think the district needs to do to prevent this violence?
Well, it's horrible, obviously. And unfortunately, the district, like other major cities across the country, has seen more violence recently. And frankly, I mean, we need to keep making investments in programs that end violence, that end conflicts, and get guns off the street. That's what the council's been pushing on, and a mayor has joined us. And what I was really happy to see recently is that now President Biden is going to be lending assistance. You know, I think it's a really important context to understand that when the president is saying, District of Columbia, I want to be with you, I want to help you fund these programs that you're implementing, that it means that we know what the solutions are, we need to use those evidence-based solutions, and now if the federal government's going to be with us, then perhaps we can finally resource them at the levels that will end violence in our communities.
And, of course, that six-year-old is called Nyaya Courtney. Tom Sherwood?
Councilmember, welcome to the program. I'll stay on crime for a moment. After the shooting of Nyaya, the six-year-old, after the shooting outside on South Capitol Street, the mayor announced, Mayor Bowser authorized the police department to use as much overtime as necessary to fight crime. Do you agree with this?
You know, I think that we need to utilize all of our resources in the way that they're most able to help, right?
So I'm specifically asking about overtime for police.
So
yes, among other things.
I am not sure if overtime for police is going to help us end violence. I mean, what I've learned over the years is that you have to do all the other interventions to end violence. And the shootings that we've seen, in particular, in my ward, at Nat Stadium, you know, regularly, the police are present, right? The police have been present. That's not a deterrent for shootings. So if we need them to help with lots of other things like deterring robberies and other things, I mean, they're partners on things that, you know, only police can do. And I'm happy to work with them on that. But when it comes to ending violence, we need to be focused on the things that we know can end it. And getting guns off the street is key. As well.
Right. Those are, let me just address that, because the mayor is going to, I'm told she's going to ask that the courts reopen, that many of the suspects who would be charged with violent crimes are not in court because of the COVID crisis, and she wants the courts to open as a public emergency, a health emergency ends on Sunday. She wants the courts to open up more quickly to deal with some of these people, because as you know and everyone knows, it's a small, very small minority of people who are engaging in all this type of shooting. But the larger question I keep hearing from people when I go around the city is, yes, we need to reform the police department. We need to do better education, job, social support, mental health issues to help people. But what about the people who are facing violent crime right now, whether it's the barber on Benning Road who sees someone shot outside his shop or the six-year-old? What do you do immediately? And that's why I ask, do you agree with the mayor saying have the police work overtime while you get the violence under control as you fix the underlying problems? Can you do both?
Tom, are you asking me about the courts, or are you asking me? I'm sorry, the question was
okay. It was a long question. The mayor says you got the courts of one. There are many aspects to crime. The mayor says we got to open the courts to prosecute people who've been arrested for violent crimes. But and you want to reform the police, and you want social services to stem crime before it happens. I'm just asking, can you do both? Reform the police, provide police protection on the streets, and provide the social services. It's not an either or, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a proponent of using all the resources that we have. But here's the thing that I am worried about. So when you see an increased police presence, oftentimes you see also innocent people caught up in it. And in communities of color in particular, we often see that. And it really is something that I hear from my residents who have been had negative interactions with police, that having more police on the streets in that sort of way, like a large infusion of them, doesn't necessarily make them feel less safe. And the evidence that we have shows that it also doesn't prevent shootings. So I think when we do use overtime, we need to do it for specific reasons that are evidence-based, and we may have them, and maybe that's what the mayor has in mind. But you know, one of the things I did last year was pass a bill that monitors the use of overtime. And so we get a regular report at the council now that shows them and how they're using their overtime dollars and whether they're going to go over each year. So, you know, I think it's something we have to keep an eye on, because the answer isn't always more police. The answer is you've got to do a little bit of each thing that actually ends the violence.
We're talking with Brianna Doe, a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 1. The Metropolitan Police Department is creating what it calls a new community-focused patrol unit, which will put squads of officers on bikes and scooters throughout the city. This will deploy initially in your ward in the Columbia Heights neighborhood. Police Chief Robert Conti says this will strengthen relationships with the community and combat gun violence. What do you think?
I mean, I think having police on bikes and Segways is way better than having them in squad cars, because they're more approachable. I mean, if you really do want to have a relationship with people in community, you have to be able to have conversations. So I've seen that. I do think in Columbia Heights, where we're going to be getting them, that's exciting, because it's an area where we've had a lot of robberies and things like that, where that type of police presence really can deter that type of crime. And coupled with the work that we're doing around violence prevention, you know, I think that might actually be a really good mix. But for sure, getting them out and about and making them more accessible is going to help build trust. And it's I think it's a better way to go than the cruisers.
Here is Guy on Oak Street in Northwest D.C. Guy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hi, Kojo. Thanks for having me. Hello to council member. First of all, I'd like to say real quick, for all the police out there that are doing it for the right reasons and are, you know, the good folks out there, I have a lot of appreciation as a 25-year resident of Columbia Heights. And I know they have a really hard job. I've talked to them many times on the street, and, you know, they want to do the right thing, and they feel, you know, a lot of pressure, I think. So just a shout-out to those guys. Thanks a lot. But my main question, you know, and I know there's a lot of competing interests here, but, you know, the little center at Park Road, we walk by there all the time, and the level of just, you know, drunken behavior out there. People look like they're dead on the streets. They smell. Yeah. They take the emergency, you know, people away from other jobs. And, you know, the drinking on the streets, they're urinating. I see it every day. I've talked to the police. They basically are like, we can't really do anything.
Well, allow me to interrupt before Brianna no answers. What do you think should be done about them, Guy?
Well, I would say that there's probably a whole host of elements, but I would definitely start with, you know, enforcing the laws that are on the books. I think that would be a really important, you know, one step to take. Of course, there's other things like other programs and money that can be spent. I'm all for that, too. But let's enforce the laws. If we're going to have laws, it seems like that would be...
Brianna Doe, guy, seems to be saying, get these people out of there.
Yeah. Guy, thank you for raising this issue. It's a really important one for me as well. And over the years, I've asked for a lot of resources to be brought to the plaza, and I just have not been satisfied with it. So in this budget, I basically created my own program. So what we're going to have starting up soon is a program targeted to the plaza for the men who are suffering from alcoholism there that is culturally competent, language specific, and can get them off the street. They're literally dying there. I mean, they're drinking themselves to death. It's a horrible disease, alcoholism. They have families, they're neighbors, they live in the community. We need to care about them and their well-being. And so that is what we're going to be focusing on. I was really proud to see the mayor also is creating what's called a sobering center. She told me it's going to be in or near Ward 1. It's a place where we can take folks who are having this issue and get them off the street. Because, you know, if the police try to get involved and you know, lock them up, you know, really, like, they're going to sit in a cell until they get sober, and then it's going to keep happening. And it's not an ideal use of resources. It's not a very humane way to address it. And it doesn't solve the issue you're asking me to solve. So I think with these new dedicated resources, we're going to be able to help these men. I know there's a lot of people in the community concerned about them for a whole host of reasons. My hope is we can serve them well and serve the community well by implementing this plan.
Guy, thank you very much. Guy, thank you for your call.
I watched the kids playing in the pop-up fountain there. This is at 14th and Park Road, for those who don't know what we're talking about. But, you know, I don't know that if a person is drunk and if he or she is not doing anything, I don't think the DC, I don't think you have the authority to take them off the street and take them to a sober place. Don't they have to agree to go? I think the caller's overall concern is that the situation for families there is out of control, and you're just limited in how you can do anything unless you see someone urinating in public, screaming and yelling and threatening other people or doing something like that. It is kind of hard to move them legally, isn't it?
Well, what I hear is people asking me to solve the issue. And so I think I've laid out the plan for that, which is, you know, we get them the treatment they need and we get them back on track, because otherwise anything that we do through the legal system is not, it's not going to solve the problem, you know, ticketing them for public drunkenness,
but like homelessness, you know, that sort of thing. You can't, but like homelessness, you can't force them into a sober treatment program, just as in homelessness, you can't force them into shelters. You can encourage them, as you said, culturally approach them in ways that maybe will get them, but you cannot, so people would understand, you cannot force someone to go into a homeless shelter. You cannot force someone to go to a sober center.
No, but you can't do that. But we also can do a better, right. But we also can do a better job of offering them something that actually makes sense for them. And I don't think we've done that.
We got a tweet from Jesse Rabinowitz, the Senior Manager of Policy and Advocacy at Miriam's Kitchen, which says, please thank my council member, Brianne Nadeau, for making the moral choice to ensure that our wealthiest residents pay their fair share to address urgent needs like ending homelessness for 24,000 households. I am proud to have voted for her. Why is Jacino Rabinowitz tweeting this? Well, the D.C. Council voted to adopt Chairman Phil Mendelson's proposed budget, but you and two other council members pushed forward an amendment that would increase income taxes on D.C.'s wealthiest residents. Please explain this new tax.
Absolutely. So we are implementing a very modest tax for the wealthiest earners in the District of Columbia, individuals making $250,000 or more, so that we can end homelessness for 2,400 people. We can raise wages for thousands of early childhood educators. So those are the people taking care of our babies, Black and brown women working hard who never stopped working during the pandemic. And also introducing a basic monthly basic income for DC individuals and families earning less than $57,000 for a family of three. So this is a transformative thing that we're doing here. We're asking our wealthiest residents to pay a little more in taxes, very little more. And in exchange, we're ending homelessness, we're raising wages, and we're giving working families more resources.
Well, D.C. got $2.3 billion in federal coronavirus relief, so some people, including the chairman of the council, Phil Mendelson, are wondering, why do we need this extra tax? What is your response?
Well, that money is here for one time, and then it's gone. And things like ending homelessness for people, housing, that has to be funded in perpetuity. So you have to have a basic understanding of how the budget works to understand this, but it's pretty simple. If the federal government gives you a one-time infusion of cash, you should use it. You should use it quickly. You should use it for important programs. But what we're talking about is stuff that needs to be ongoing. And the only way you can do that is through regular revenue, regular income.
And Councilmember, I think it's important for, I think a lot of people don't know this, that under the tax city's tax program, a person who makes $60,000 a year under the current plan pays the same taxes as someone who makes $350,000. So what the council has done is they've stepped into this gap and raised taxes for people who earn over new taxes on money over $250,000. So that's where it fits. There's a real inequity in the way the tax system is laid out in terms of rates. But let me ask you, one of the things the chairman said was, why don't we wait until the Tax Review Commission gives us a full report like it did in the early 2000s and then make changes? Why now?
Because I can't live with myself letting another person die on the street. That's why now. I mean, we have already 43 homeless people this year who have died sleeping on the streets. And we know the answer. The answer is housing. So it's up to us to fund it. That's what we're doing. And we need to fund it on a recurring basis. So this very modest tax increase is going to raise enough money to permanently house 2,400 more people.
Where will you put them?
All over. They can live wherever they want. These are vouchers. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Well, this is not quite over the hump yet, because the amendment passed 8-5, which is not a veto-proof majority. Do you have any sense of what the mayor will do if this gets to her desk?
I mean, is she going to veto the budget? That's up to her. This will be part of the full budget package.
The budget also includes...
Can we ask this question?
Tom? Sure.
The budget's like $17 billion or something. Can the mayor do line item budget vetoes?
I've never seen her do it.
Can she?
I don't think she can.
So that would...
Yeah, I don't think so.
I guess we're about to find out.
Nothing, I think. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'll Google it for you. I'll Google it, Tom. One of us should know the answer to that. Yeah.
The budget also includes funding for something called a baby bonds program, something that your colleague Kenyon McDuffie proposed earlier this year. What was this program do?
This is a beautiful thing that Kenyon proposed, and I'm so glad we're adopting it. The district's going to invest in savings bonds, savings accounts for young people in need. And they'll be able to collect it when they turn 18 to go to school or start a business. It really is going to help. I mean, this is an equity measure. This is creating equity among families that haven't had the opportunity to build generational wealth. I mean, this is a beautiful thing.
Here now is Greg in Mount Pleasant. Greg, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for having me. Look, the district couldn't get the unemployment checks out. Can't get the state DC money out. Have no affordable housing base. The Housing Production Trust Fund has only spent 19% of its money. You are unhappy with your own rapid rehousing program. Why do we want to give you $100 million to address problems that, in many cases, the council has created through their lack of oversight and mismanagement?
I'm not really sure what the reference to me being unhappy with the rapid rehousing program is, but let me talk to the other parts. So I have been working furiously, essentially, to get people housed since I became chair of the Committee on Human Services. Every year, the Department of Human Services spends down what we give them. And what's happened is the Housing Authority has had trouble matching people and getting things out the door. And so what I did was this year requested oversight of the Housing Authority's programs that do this. And I've gotten it, and we have been getting them on track. So they've been ramping up and getting people matched and housed. And then there's a few other things. So we've now got a non-lapsing fund so that any of the money that is going to these vouchers will stay in that fund from perpetuity. Because what you see, no matter what, is at the end of a fiscal year, things sort of ramp down. So there's always a little underspending as people are not, being matched up at the end of the fiscal year. But with this non-lapsing fund, Folks are going to really be able to keep pushing through because they understand the money will still be available. No one's taking it away in the next fiscal year. We've actually made a lot of changes to the system that allow me to feel confident that we can house people. I already started talking with the Department of Human Services about the implementation of these funds, which I understand is a little premature because we haven't done the second vote yet. But I don't like to sit around and wait to get things done. I'm a doer here. So I'm very confident that we're going to use this money. And frankly, we don't have the choice not to because people are dying on the streets. And I can't think of, something of this magnitude and funding it in this way is probably one of the most critical and important things we will do in this generation. And we've got to finish the plan of Homeward DC. And we've got to fund these housing units or we're never going to end homelessness.
It would appear that the mayor does have line item veto power in D.C. We checked. There was a reference.
Did you Google?
We checked a reference. Apparently, Vincent Gray did this for three items back in 2014. So we'll have to see what happens.
I also have checked on this with somebody I know. The mayor would have to veto the Budget Support Act and the budget itself and return it to the council, specifying why she is vetoing the budget. So then she would identify the things that she doesn't want, and then the council could override those or not. May I move on to something else, Kojo?
Wanted to get in William in Ward 1 quickly. William, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Great. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, William.
Great. Subject right there. Please, Madam Chairperson, Councilperson, please support the homeless people trying to remain in those hotels that they've been in about the COVID thing. Y'all about to cut that short and they're going to be on the street and they're going to spread the COVID everywhere. And no one's thinking about them. They're doing the petition drive. Have your staff and other council members support it if they support this. We need to get that done. Those people are really working on their own behalf of advocates and getting those support. But that's a great opportunity. You support funds to buy those buildings, keep them there, and put a program there for them. Like you said,
Councilmember Nadeau.
William, thank you for that. It's a really important issue. I want them to be housed, right? Like, we don't want them out on the streets. We want them to be housed. We want them to be vaccinated. We want them to be supported. I do think we're going to end up acquiring some hotels, probably not in time for the end of the public health emergency. But with these vouchers and some of the other programs that we're putting into place, we can help them. And nobody wants to see the people that we've housed during the pandemic all of a sudden become homeless again. It's a huge priority for me. So thank you for speaking up on that.
I'm sure would you get the last question?
Oh, well, no, we're done?
Gets the last question.
The council got a lot of praise for passing the ban of flavored cigarettes. However, the council passed it without putting any money in the bill. Do you think before you pass the budget, you'll put the $3 million in to fund the ban on flavored cigarettes? Otherwise, it seems like it was a useless exercise.
I do not know the answer to that. I'm not sure if someone's looking for that money or not.
Okay, you pass something that doesn't take effect unless you put money behind it, and that's the flavored cigarettes.
Most of the time, right? So most of the time when we pass legislation, it is subject to appropriations.
There are hundreds of bills over the years who don't get funded. But okay, yeah. We're out of time.
But I don't know if somebody, the authors of that bill perhaps, would be able to tell you if they've been trying to find the funding.
Anyway, banning flavored cigarettes is not funded, folks.
Brianne Nadeau is a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 1. Brianne Nadeau, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's always my pleasure.
The Politics Hour is produced by we got to insert some pain in there. The Politics Hour is produced by Sydney Grannon, and our managing producer is Ingelisa Schorpsdorf. A special thank you to Catherine Whalen, who helped us out behind the scenes today. Any big plans this weekend, Tom Sherwood?
The Olympics are starting. I think they're going to start if everyone doesn't get COVID. I'll be watching the Olympics.
It's early in the morning, so I started recording mine this morning very, very early, and we'll watch it this afternoon. But you all have a great weekend. Thank you for listening, and stay safe. I'm Kojo Nambi.
The Politics Hour with Kojo Nambi is produced by Sydney Grannon. Our managing producer is Ingelisa Schrobsdorf. Our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. Today's engineer was Kenny Pirog. Mona Cashby oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows and more content, visit thepoliticshour.org.